Hello, you're listening to Truth News Radio Australia on this Thursday, the 18th of March, 2010. Tonight, we're bringing you a story that is quite galling. I'm going to spend some time going through a document that was released, a joint document released by the CSIRO and the Department Bureau of Meteorology called State of the Climate. And it positions itself as being a purely objective, purely science-based, unemotional snapshot of the climate in Australia and the history of the climate and the factors that influence it. Now, when I first saw this on the news, I thought, great, you know, there could be this this study and, you know, whatever it comes up with, it's purely scientific, it's unemotional, it's just going to give us the facts. And but I did notice the way it was covered was already being heavily slanted and heavily spun to say that basically this statement finally puts to rest, you know, climate skeptics and, you know, proves that the climate is actually changing and changing because of human activity. But I thought, look, I'll actually, you know, bypass the spin doctors of the mainstream media and the broadsheets and the radio, and I'll just go straight to the document. So I downloaded the actual document and I had a read of it. And what did I find? It's just an incredibly shallow, incredibly obviously biased document for the simple fact that it doesn't go before 1960. It doesn't go back beyond 1960. And as we know, I mean, 50 years is a very short span of time in history, in the climate, the changes that occur in our climate and geology. We know you really have to look over vast periods of time to see proper changes. But what's odd about this is that we know that the climate records held by the Bureau of Meteorology go back at least 100 years, and in many cases 150 years, and yet they stop at that point 50 years ago. Anyway, we'll be getting into that shortly, but I just want to run through some headlines here of some of the other stories that are breaking at the moment before we do that. Okay, some of our top stories tonight. We have Google appears to drop censorship in China. And in 2007, Australian government wanted to empower the federal police to control a blacklist of blocked web pages. Drugs before diagnosis. A Melbourne psychiatrist, Patrick McGorry, thinks that would be a great idea. That's a proposal that kids in high-risk situations should be drugged even before they're diagnosed with a mental illness. A report names enemies of the internet. The Reporters Without Borders list has grown twice as long as last year, and Australia has been added to that list as a country on the watch list. We have a Liberal Party Senator McGoran attacking the CSIRO on climate change, and we'll be getting more into that shortly. We have a new book by an Australian journalist, John Morgan, which reveals a raft of inconsistencies surrounding the death of Princess Diana. Really interesting story, that one, and I'd like to do a whole show or even a series of shows on that one. It's one we have subject we haven't looked at, and really, really crying out to be examined from, you know, an objective, non-biased perspective. Cynthia McKinney and Dr. Nafees Ahmed discuss 9/11 in UK Parliament. Really important development there, seeing some very high-profile and highly respected people bringing up the topic of 9/11 and the failures and the forewarnings of 9/11 in the House of Parliament in the UK. And we have EFA responds to Senator Conroy's accusation that they have run a disgraceful misinformation campaign. Important development. We've got a lot of developments in relation to the net filter that we need to cover. So bear with us. I'm going to be joined shortly by Josh Jackson, and we're going to get into some meaty subjects for the next 25 minutes or so. Then we're going to be joined by a lawyer, Rochelle McCready, a human rights advocate and an advocate of people who suffer from mental illness, who's going to go through some issues and concerns and describe her experience to us. So that's a really important interview coming up in about half an hour. So please stand by and we will be right back with you. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, on with the show and welcoming for the next segment, Josh Jackson. Josh, how's your week been?
Glorious. Absolutely glorious. I tell you, it's just...
great to hear it. Great to hear it.
Stunning, yeah.
Great weather, great glorious weather, beautiful autumn.
Yep. Beautiful people.
Beautiful
lots
people.
Lots of great information coming out. It's
a classic autumn, wouldn't you say, what we're having now? Classic Sydney autumn. You know, warm days, cool nights.
Yeah, it's it's just lovely. I mean, apart from the construction work going on outside my bedroom window, that's 7 in the morning, that's really not fun. But apart from that, everything's dandy.
Everything's dandy, except not according to the CSIRO and the Department or Bureau of Meteorology. Two of the greatest...
Great segue there.
Thanks. Now, as we all know... the CSIRO and Bureau of Meteorology are, you know, unimpeachable.
Taxpayer funded.
Yes, thank you. Institutions, although CSIRO does actually get a large part of its money from private industry as well, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Bureau of Meteorology, I think, is purely taxpayer funded. But actually, I mean, we'll get into that aspect of how these organizations are funded because it's quite interesting as well. But let's just talk about this document, State of the Climate. Because I actually, having read it, I would actually like to sue them. I mean, I would actually like to take legal action against them because I feel that the document itself, on a prima facie level, shows deliberate intention to deceive, and mainly because it only goes back 50 years. I mean, that in itself is prima facie evidence of a deliberate intent to deceive. Well, it actually goes back to 1960, so it's actually only 50 years.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yep. Yeah, it goes back to 1960, which was 50 years ago. And, I mean, we know they've got records that go back at least 100, if not 150 years. And why is that important? Well, I mean, A, 50 years is an incredibly short time span to measure anything, right? So if you had more records, you'd want to include them. You'd want to have as much as you could, wouldn't you? You wouldn't just want to rely on the smaller segment to make a decision or to make an observation.
Oh, but, well, unless you wanted to... Well, to deceive,
and especially
it's like if you had a graph on a company that's been doing, you know, really well or badly, and you wanted to show the potential investors how good your company's been, you just show them the little bit of the graph that's doing really well.
Yeah, it's a PR exercise. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, every organization, every commercial organization uses graphs to woo people, to wow people, to subject people to sort of, you know, it's a classic corporate game, isn't it? Showing them the graph, showing them the pie charts.
Some shapes.
Yeah. Showing them how it goes into a hockey stick towards the end. See, that generates the excitement, that hockey stick shape. And
look, I'm a big fan of graphs. You know, graphs have their place, absolutely. But show me the whole graph.
Graphs can
show
be fun.
Show me as much graph as you possibly can, not just the bit that goes, you know, in your favour. Now, I've just got to interject here.
Go ahead, interject.
All this goes back to something that reminded me of it when I was reading it is Clive Spash. He was a scientist at the CSIRO, and he retired, I think it was in 2009, late 2009, he retired and he called for a Senate inquiry into the CSIRO because he resigned, because he felt that it was the CSIRO was censoring him because he had a controversial publication he wanted to publish into the emissions trading scheme. He lashed out at the organization. And he said that it was a self censorship, you know, that the people on top, people at the I've forgotten the name of the head of the CSIRO. It's a
yes, we
it's a
have
woman
that
by the
here.
name of
I think we can get that up.
she's in my notes here somewhere. Anyhow, basically saying that you know they basically censored his paper. I mean, why would you want to censor a paper about something? I mean, he's obviously a very good scientist, and he's showing that side of things. And no, don't have it in there.
That's right. Now,
I mean, just as much, I wouldn't want someone censored that is showing some amazing evidence for climate change. I mean, I want to see the truth. I don't go around just looking for the negative. And that's what it looks like to me, is that all they're doing is looking for the negative. All they're doing is saying, oh no, we're warming, this is so negative. That's all they're looking for.
The head of CSIRO is Megan Clark, Dr.
Megan
Clark,
that's
by the way.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
So,
look,
yeah.
I tell you what I think is that if it was true, if it was genuine, if it was honest, you know, like if my house was burning down and I was at a party and you came and tried to tell me my house was burning down and I said, oh, go away, I don't want to hear that. You know, I bet I'd want you to tell me if my house was burning down, even if I didn't want to hear that, right? Like if it really was an emergency like that. Now, this is the way it's always been portrayed with climate change by the extremists, by the extreme alarmists, is that it's like it's an emergency, your house is burning down. Now, if it were true, we would want to know. But what it appears to be is that it's not true. And this goes to the core of it, right? Because these people who are supposedly part of the most objective, respected system of knowledge we have, which is science, telling and using the mantle, using the garb of science to make us believe them, are telling us lies, and I have to just call them lies.
Now, folks, if you want to pull up this document while we talk through it, it is available on
it's on the Twitter stream, and it'll be on our show notes for sure. Yeah, yeah.
But if you want to Google it, just Google CSIRO State of the Climate, and I'm sure you'll find
or climate snapshot, perhaps.
Climate snapshot. In Google nowadays, you can sort by date. So
yeah, that's great.
Find the latest one.
I mean, let's look at
Twitter feed, twitter.com/truthnewsoz or OZ for you guys in America.
Absolutely.
Okay,
let's look at the first graph. Yeah, number one, temperature. Okay, there's a photograph, image here of Australia with regions marked in different colours, and we've got...
No, hang on. It's marked in one colour, and that's red.
Well, yeah, yes. Different grades of red, indeed. And it says here, since 1960, the mean temperature in Australia has increased by about 0.7 degrees centigrade. The long-term trend in temperature is clear. Well, what do they mean by the long-term trend? Since 1960, is that a long-term trend? You see, I need to deconstruct sentence by sentence what they say here. Because, see, when they say the long-term trend in temperature is clear, they're not defining their definition of long-term. To me, long-term, well, let's start at maybe 10,000 years, shall we? I mean, long-term? Okay. What do they mean? Anyway, continuing. But there is still substantial year-to-year variability of about plus minus 0.5 degrees centigrade. Isn't that interesting? There's year-to-year variability of 0.5 degrees centigrade. So that's quite a lot of variability, actually, compared to the so-called increase, which is only 0.7. Okay, so already we're starting to see some little bit of inconsistency there in terms of what they're saying. It says that some areas have experienced warming of 1.5 to 2 degrees over the last 50 years. Warming has occurred in all seasons. However, the strongest warming has occurred in spring and the weakest in summer. Now, let me just clarify here my understanding. And obviously, I'm not an expert. I'm not a climate scientist, not even a scientist. But I've done my fair share of reading on this. And I know that on average, the global climate has been warming since about 1850, since we reached the bottom of what was called the Maunder Minimum, which was a period of very, very cold climate known as the... known as the Little Ice Age, right? And it was quite cold back then everywhere. The Thames freezed over, You know, it was there were famines. It was a very bad time, it was a very bleak time. And since about the mid 19th century, there has been a steady increase in temperature. It goes in fits and starts. Like it'll warm up and then it'll cool down a little. Warm up and it'll cool down a little. That's the way every natural system works. Okay,
but look. Just to interject there, in the last 50 years, from 1960, what do you really expect Australia to stay exactly every year the same?
Well, exactly. I mean, if you were to look at any period of 50 years and compare one end to the other, I guarantee you would see a trend of at least what they've said here in either sometimes warm and sometimes cool. I guarantee it. I mean, and that's why this presentation of this information is just so despicable. Honestly, I'm really angry about this, Josh, and I'm going to speak to lawyers about this. I'm going to speak to the climate skeptics about it. I want us to, because I'm paying
Look,
for these
and if
people.
Anyone's out there that is even more irate than young Herowood, to get out there and set up a class action or something.
Well, I mean, they're deceiving. They're taking our taxpayer money. They're corrupting the scientific process. There's got to be so many things there. To me, at least a civil lawsuit, if not an actual criminal lawsuit. Anyway, we'll get onto that later.
Well,
it'll be the subject of another
show.
The thing
is also to add to that is the news jumped onto this like it was gospel straight away, right? CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology have gotten together and last 50 years we've been warming and the dispute is over. Doesn't matter about ClimateGate. That's what a couple of news articles said. Forget about ClimateGate. The CSIRO have told us now that it's true.
Now, let me just move on to the next series of graphs here. The next one is number of record hot day maximums at Australian climate reference stations. Now, if you look at this graph, it's got amazing hockey stick at the end of it. Did you see that? Like, it's got it at the end of the graph right at 2010. And bear in mind, we're only in March of 2010 now. They've put a hockey stick in there. Now, what on earth is that? I mean, we're not in a position to examine this, but it seems very strange, doesn't it? I mean, look at it.
Well, it goes beyond 50 degrees.
Well, is that number possible?
Of inches. Oh, no, sorry.
Well, number of record hot days per annum for each decade. But the red bars are the average. The grey is...
You know what that is. That just draws up the average.
I just don't know.
I wonder what it is. Yeah.
I mean
it's just... I tell you right now.
I mean, if this is correct, I mean, the last 3 months have been some incredible thing has happened in the last 3 months.
Yeah. Is that possible? And I don't know about you listeners out there, but I really have felt about 3 years ago was a killer summer, was an absolute scorcher.
Yeah.
And it was one of the hottest that I can remember. I mean, it was really, really, really hot. But last year, this year, it's been fine. Like, I mean,
yeah, it's
it
been
hot,
warm. You know, it's been consistently
Australian
warm.
Hot. I mean, yeah. Australia is a hot place, folks.
Yeah, we have a hot summer.
When Captain Cook came out here, he was sweating, and he was saying, you know, this is a crazy hot place, you're going to find it hard growing crops down south because it's just. You get the hot northerlies blowing off the desert. It's just killer.
Now, I just like my, you know, listeners, if they get this graph and have a look at it on page 2 of the document, and just get rid of that last millimeter of the graph and just cut it there, right? Then look at the graph again. Because without that hockey stick at the end, it doesn't really look like there's a hell of a lot of trend there, does it? I mean, there's so much variability in the individual spikes.
When you say hockey stick, I mean... It really, literally is the last, you know, what?
The last
half a year where it's just gone whack.
Yeah.
Like, twice as much as the highest in the last 50 years.
I mean, yeah, and if that's true, then something incredible has just happened in the last 3 months. But I mean, it just seems, I mean, normally they don't release information that close to the present. You know, that seems to me, because I know it takes them a while to collate all their figures and stuff. So I find it hard to believe they would actually have figures for 2010 already. You know what I mean? Like it takes them a while to gather all that data and process it. They've got to get their programmers and all the different people together. I mean, we've got to investigate. It's got to be investigated. It has to be put to scrutiny. And then anything that we find, when we find that there's deliberate disinformation, it has to be called out. The first stage, I'm saying, is that we have to call them out. We have to show that they're lying. Second stage is we've got to take legal action against them. And I just want to emphasize the really overriding concern here. If you're having questions about anything I'm saying, maybe doubting what I'm saying, there is one thing that I'm absolutely rock solid on here, is that when they start the graph there at 1960, that itself is totally outrageous, because wouldn't you like to see the previous 50 years? And imagine if you saw the previous 50 years, what would you see? Look at that graph with the extra 50 years prior to 1960.
And
Do you think you would see the trend anymore? I bet you wouldn't.
I mean, even in I know. Even 100 years.
I know, that's the barest minimum that we could provide that is available. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. But there's other ways. You know, there's satellite, there's tree barks, and there's...
Oh, yeah, there's the various other forms of proxy data.
Soil samples and ice cores. You know, there's all sorts of stuff. I'm sure, you know, there's fantastic ways of figuring out data.
But see, I'm actually proposing an argument here that I would use in court. And I would say that they chose 1960 as the cutoff date for a very specific reason. It wasn't just arbitrary. They chose 1960 because we know, you and I know, Josh, that all the accepted temperature records show very high temperatures in the 1930s, followed by a decline that started around about the 1940s and went through to the mid-1970s. We know that. It's well accepted. So the choice of 1960 as the start date, I'm saying, was done for the same reason that your big corporation, when they show graphs, you know, they choose where they're going to start, how they're going to scale it to make it look the way they want it to look. Because if they started at 1900, you would not see the trend that they want you to see.
It's classic spin.
Classic spin.
Okay. Moving on down, we've got number of record cold day maximums at Australia climate reference stations. You know, the thing is, I'd like to see where these reference stations are also. Because
very important. We need
no
that.
Matter how much they've gone about that the urban heating effect doesn't matter, it actually does, because I've seen the effect. In fact, a young 9-year-old kid or something like that did it with his father. He basically got the weather stations in the United States. He then had a look at the data from the ones in the city. Then the closest weather station to the city that's in a country area, he took and had a look at the average. Now, he lined up every one of those, and he did it to like 50 different weather stations, or 30 or 40 different weather stations, quite a lot. And every single one of them, the city always had a heating trend. And this was over a, you know, 100-year period. So to say that there's no such thing as urban warming, and I know that that's a very simple test, but simplicity is where it's at, folks. I mean, give me a whole bunch of thermometers and tell me which way they're going. Plot the graph every year. And what are they doing? That's simplicity. Now, you add extra layers of complexity in. Well, there's this fact of urban warming, where the hot concrete, the black bitumen that we lay down, the air conditioning ducts, the planes flying over, the all this stuff has and chopping down the trees in an urban area all have a cumulative effect of slight heating. Now, when you average those out, you get a heating effect, but localized.
Correct. And look, we need to get the climate records measurements that were used to compile this report. Maybe it was done using only regional areas that haven't changed. We don't know. They haven't told us.
I'd like to know.
We have to get the data there. Let's just have a quick look at rainfall. We're going to have to wind this up shortly because we've got a guest coming on. Rainfall. While total rainfall of the Australian continent has been relatively stable, the geographic distribution of rainfall has changed significantly over the past 50 years. Now, That's an interesting thing that they've said there. The total rainfall on the continent has been relatively stable. Isn't that interesting?
Mm.
I mean, would you, you know, okay. So it's the pattern has changed. Well, you know, there's been a lot of different views as to what rainfall patterns would be under various scenarios of climate change. And guess what? There's so many different, you know, theses being written about that. So many different ideas. They're all just speculations.
You have whole systems of weather, like the El Nino effect that come down from this and that all affect rainfall from different places. You know, also deforestation has a big effect on different types of rainfall, and that's something that has to be battled for sure. I mean, we forest like crazy in certain areas.
But the great thing is that the overall rainfall hasn't.
The green movement is totally taken over by this ridiculous notion of global warming, when there is true problems that are happening of plastics and deforestation. Anyway, I'm going off the path of this.
The great thing is that the average rainfall over that time hasn't really changed. The patterns have changed, but isn't that great news? Hey, you know,
hey,
it's not quite
news.
As terrible as you might have thought. You know, that we're still getting about the same amount of rain as we did.
It is. And, you know, people say to us, Josh, Herod, why are you so negative? Well, we're not. We're trying to be positive. We're saying, hey, guess what? There's no problem.
Yeah. And the same thing applies to the other subjects like sea levels rise. Well, the sea level rises by their own graph. The trend hasn't changed. The trend is the same since about the turn of the century. You know, and the same goes with everything related to the way the climate's been changing according to all the proper ways that have been used to study it. It has showed a gradual warming since the end of the Little Ice Age, gradual melting of glaciers, gradual rise of sea level. Guess what? We came out of the Little Ice Age. We're still perhaps on our way out. We may have peaked, and we may be starting to cool again. We don't know yet. We'll know in maybe another 100 years, but we'll be dead, okay? Our children will know.
I love how the global average sea level rose to close to, since 1870 to 2007, it rose close to 200 millimetres. I mean, really. I mean, you know, it's just...
Indeed.
What is that, 200 millimetres? Because the oceans rise and fall. It's part of... That doesn't prove anything about man-made. Is it man-made?
Look, I would love to get more into this topic, but we're going to have to break now. Josh, are you good to stay for the second half? We're going to get a lawyer on, and we're going to be going through some really important issues of psychiatry and human rights.
Oh, bring it on.
Okay, bring it on. I'll just we'll just go for a break here, and we'll be right back with our guest for tonight. So please stand by. This is a Pink Floyd song, Childhood's End, classic track from the early 70s.
Never voiced, say you have to make the final choice.
Sick of the propaganda, when you're over the disinformation, when you can't stand the deception, when the deceit gets too much, when the spin becomes transparent, you know where to turn. You turn on truthnews.com.au with your hosts, Harold Fenton and Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to Truth News Radio. Well, in the second half of tonight's show, I have a guest by the name of Rochelle McCready. Rochelle is a solicitor with well over 20 years' experience. She has represented a number of people under the Mental Health Act. She does volunteer work with the Citizens Committee on Human Rights and will today be talking about how easy it is to be involuntarily detained by psychiatry. Rochelle has a Bachelor of Arts in Social Science, Bachelor of Science in Pure Mathematics, Statistics and Philosophy, and a Bachelor of Law. She works for Oliveri Lawyers in East Sydney, who practice a variety of areas, including criminal law, mental health advocacy, family law, commercial law, wills and probate, equity, and involuntary vaccination matters. The first consultation is free, so if anyone's interested after this to get in touch, we'll provide all that information on our show notes. I'd just like to welcome Rochelle to the show. Rochelle, are you there?
Yes, I am, Harold. Thank you.
Fantastic. Really very impressive bio there. I didn't realise you had such a wide range of qualifications and knowledge. I'm really pleased to be to actually have a lawyer on our show. We haven't had one before, and I think we need more. In fact, I was talking just in the past segment about, because I know you're pretty aware of some of the confusion around climate change, and I've actually been thinking that we actually need to get some legal representation for the people against the government and some of the institutions such as the CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology, who appear to be leading us up a garden path. But I know it's a separate topic. But I'm basically very keen on getting lawyers involved in our truth and justice questions, so that we can have a teeth. You know, we need teeth. We can't just be sort of always complaining and always saying, you know, we're not happy. We need to actually use the legal system, because I think that can be very powerful.
Yes, I agree.
Excellent, excellent. Well, look, Rochelle, I will just turn it over to you to lead us through some of these issues about what you've experienced with the Mental Health Act and involuntary detainment. And I know there's some recent developments there, such as the new statute that says that people can be held for up to 4 weeks now without being put before, what is it, a committee or, you know, an evaluation or whatever. So that's, you know, quite disturbing.
Yes.
So look, over to you to you know, lead us through this.
Thank you, Harold. Well, what I'd like to do is just tell people a brief outline of the matter. These proposed changes, they're actually not legislative changes yet. I heard about them, I read about them in the Sydney Morning Herald article, and I immediately went to the parliamentary website and did a search for the bill or the act. I couldn't find any reference to it. I then went to the New South Wales legislation website. I conducted all manner of searches, keywords, looking for the likely date range of the bill, looking for under various titles, and I couldn't find anything. I spent about 3 hours searching, and eventually I contacted the Mental Health Review Tribunal, where I was told that there was actually no bill yet, but that these changes are being proposed, which is good news for us because it means that we have a chance to protest to our local state members of parliament and to tell them that this sort of thing has no place in a democracy. And I'm very keen to urge people to do something about this. At the end of my talk, I'll tell people exactly how I think they should go about things to have the maximum impact. But I'll just briefly outline the proposed changes. What the government wish to do is to detain people who are involuntarily incarcerated in mental institutions for a period of up to 4 weeks now before they can appear before any sort of review body. And during this time, of course, they can be drugged or they can be given shock treatment, and they're just there at the mercy of the system. And the magistrate was really the only impartial person in this process. What happens is that when a person is involuntarily admitted, they usually go before a magistrate within about a week. Most people do seek an adjournment at that stage, but the magistrate will make a determination as to whether the person is a mentally ill person or a mentally disordered person within the meaning of the Act, or otherwise that the person is not. And if the person is not, then they cannot be detained. But these proposed changes to the legislation appear to make provisions for people who are found to be not mentally ill to nonetheless be forced into community treatment. That's a bit ambiguous, but I have a copy of a text of a letter signed by the chairman of the Mental Health Review Tribunal, Greg James QC, and there are some things in there that cause me a lot of concern. And the other thing is that, you know, they do want to get rid of this magistrate now. They are the only person who isn't hired or fired by the Centre for Mental Health.
Right.
Now, you may be aware that a number of years ago that there was a lot of violation of human rights by a hospital called Chelmsford, and a number of doctors, of whom the late Dr. Harry Bailey was one.
That was the deep sleep therapy, wasn't it?
People were involuntarily incarcerated. Right. They had psychosurgery performed on them without their permission. They were given shock treatment. Relatives who complained about them were involuntarily committed and subject to the same sort of outrages. Anyway, the matter came before these outrages came before the Slattery Royal Commission. And the findings of the Slattery Royal Commission were that, you know, the hospital had well and truly overstepped its mark, and his psychiatry came out pretty much as being out of control. And what happened was a group of very sensible civil libertarians got together and they put a very good piece of mental health legislation together. It was a predecessor of the present Mental Health Act. But this thing incorporated all manner of checks and balances. Before unfortunate citizens could be involuntarily incarcerated and forced to have psychiatric treatment, they had to go before a tribunal of three people. There would be a psychiatrist so they could understand all the psychiatric stuff, a lawyer to understand the legalities, and then the third person was a lay person, a member of the public, and they were there to inject common sense into the matter. Now, what happened is that these people who have been perpetrating psychiatric outrages have never really given up the view that they should be subject to any sort of scrutiny, and they've been working very hard to wind back those reforms, chipping away at the system, And they've made a lot of ground, because what's happened is that the Centre for Mental Health now hires and fires the Mental Health Review Tribunal. Now, they're the very people who are supposed to be scrutinising and supervising the behaviour of the psychiatrists and other mental health workers. But the situation we have now is analogous to the sort of thing where if the mafia hired the police and the judiciary.
Yes.
Now, the magistrate is the only independent person. I'll stress this again. They're a local court magistrate. They go into the system. And they're there basically to keep people honest and see that people comply with the law. Well, the proposal is to get rid of them and have all appeals go before a single, the legal member of the Mental Health Review Tribunal.
It's like a special tribunal, right? So it's not like a judge. It's not like someone who's a totally independent individual.
No, this tribunal's been these members have been, hired by the Centre for Mental Health, the people who they're supposed to be sort of scrutinising.
Yes.
So it's not really independent at all. And also the thing is that a lesser standard of proof is involved. So people who are accused of being mentally ill have fewer rights than criminals, because when a person is accused of a criminal offence, they have to be proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt, which is a pretty onerous sort of standard. But if a person is accused of being mentally ill, they only have to be shown to be more likely to be mentally ill than not. And I'll go into this later, but psychiatry is not a science, it's not a proper branch of medicine, and it doesn't have any objective biological tests to determine the presence or the absence of any of the conditions that it diagnoses or treats. Now, the last change in this proposal is to do away with face-to-face hearings and replace them with video conferences, which is the sort of thing we're seeing in criminal law now. Now, Harold, I'd like to make a very firm statement.
Certainly.
I do not have any problem with psychiatry per se. I think there have been some very good psychiatrists, and I can cite an excellent example of psychiatry practiced properly and a very, very sensible reference by the late Dr. Sidney Walker III, and it's called A Dose of Sanity. Now, the late Dr. Sidney Walker III was a psychiatrist and a psychiatric neurologist, and the man worked wonders. He took all manner of people who'd been diagnosed as having psychiatric conditions and checked them out to find out the cause of their aberrant behaviour.
Yes.
And he found all manner of things, that one fellow had syphilis, which he got from a tattoo in Vietnam. Another fellow had a brain tumour and he'd just been diagnosed as being a depressive, given numerous sort of antidepressant shock treatment and all manner of things. And he would have died if Dr. Walker hadn't found this brain tumour. It would have become inoperable. I mean, no attempt was made to find any physical cause. They just simply labelled and drugged. That is the kind of psychiatry that is very, very dangerous, because it poses a massive threat to people's civil liberties, to their human rights, and it
Absolutely.
Should not be allowed to go ahead unchecked. Now, what I'd like to turn to is the specifics. I've received a copy of the text of Greg James QC's letter concerning the proposed changes to the Mental Health Act, and I'd like to read one of the paragraphs here which causes me grave concern. And it relates to the timing of mental health inquiries. And it said, the tribunal proposes that its inquiries will be conducted after sufficient time has elapsed to allow the treating team to properly assess whether the person should continue to be detained in the facility or discharged, and to develop an appropriate community treatment or discharge plan, and for the necessary information to be obtained for the tribunal to make the appropriate decision. Now, this wording concerns me because it suggests that people will only be released on either an appropriate community treatment plan or a follow-up plan. And while this may be appropriate if a person has a mental condition, it's clearly not appropriate in the case where the person does not. Nonetheless, the proposed changes, I say, appear to adopt the view that there's no such thing as a false positive and where there's smoke, there's fire. And this is something we really do need to be jumping up and down about.
Yes.
These proposed changes to the Mental Health Act have come under criticism from a magistrate who was in the system, Susan Schreiner, who's a very fine magistrate. She certainly knows her law. I've appeared in front of her. And she's very fair, and she's made some very pertinent criticisms. She said studies, I'm just quoting from a letter Ms. Schreiner wrote to the Sydney Morning Herald. It was on the 16th, if I'm correct. Anyway, she said studies have shown that the context in which a person arrives at a psychiatric hospital has a big influence on a doctor's opinion as to whether the person has a mental illness. Human behaviours are many and varied, and their interpretation is subjective. What may seem merely eccentric to one person can be viewed as abnormal by another. Psychiatric hospitals are understaffed, and trainee doctors working there are often inadequately supervised. The frequent result is that people are inappropriately detained. Now, in most cases, this legislation will take about 2 weeks before a person goes before this inquiry, but what I want to know is why the hell does it take psychiatrists 2 weeks to find out what's wrong with someone? We have doctors in casualty departments, and they are required to find out what's wrong with someone very quickly, and if they don't, people will die. Well, I want to know why, if psychiatry is a science and a proper branch of medicine and all the rest, why it should take them at least a fortnight to find out what is actually wrong with someone. That's something that I think needs to be looked at. Now, as I've said, the magistrates are the only ones who are independent in the process. The thing is that, of course, these proposals plan to get rid of the magistrate. Now, there is a real problem involving involuntary detention of people for up to 3 to 4 week period, and that is that they will almost certainly be subject during that period to treatment with potent mind-altering drugs that, by psychiatrists' own admission, are capable of causing irreversible damage to the central nervous system. And during this period, a patient could even have electroconvulsive therapy forced on them. This is very disconcerting. Now, what I'd like to talk about is some facts about psychiatry, and that is that it has an appalling record of misdiagnosing medical conditions as psychiatric complaints. I've seen a number of this with my own clients. I've seen a person with a thyroid condition, a life-threatening thyroid condition, being diagnosed as bipolar. I had another client who had infectious hepatitis, diagnosed as schizophrenic. And I'm acting for someone at the moment, and this lady's crime was that she went for a walk at dawn and she was picked up by a mental health crisis team and promptly labelled bipolar for being up early in the morning. She wasn't just getting up early and clearing her head and getting a bit of exercise and wanting to get on with the paperwork and the right frame of mind. No, there was something wrong with her. Now, the thing is that there are no tests to determine the presence or absence of a mental illness. If a psychiatrist says somebody has a mental illness, they can't perform a blood or urine test to determine the presence or absence of that test. Now, I'm not the one who's saying that. That's said by Joseph Glenn Mullen, who's a Harvard psychiatrist, and he's the author of Prozac Backlash, and also by Thomas Sass, who's a professor emeritus of psychiatry at Syracuse University. Now, there's a demonstrable and acknowledged and significant risk of brain damage resulting as a consequence of the administration of psychiatric drugs. And the person who said this is a PhD. His name is Elliot Valenstein, and he's the author of Blaming the Brain, The Truth About Drugs and Mental Health. Now, on the basis of psychiatric presumptions, there's a common assumption that psychotic disorders have a prevalence rate at 2 to 3% in the community. But the notion that in theory anyone can be forcibly detained and drugged is completely statistically unsustainable on this basis. And I'm drawing my references here from Richard Gosden's book, Punishing the Patient, How Psychiatrists Misunderstand and Mistreat Schizophrenia. Also, I will state something that there's been a lot of reference to people having chemical imbalances in the brain.
Yes, indeed.
Now,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, yeah. I'd like to make this very clear. Professor Emeritus Thomas Szasz has made this statement many times. When you talk about a chemical imbalance in the brain, there is no way you can test the brain biochemistry of a living person or any other organism for that matter without damaging the brain. So you really can't test their brain biochemistry at all. It's just a presumption on these people's behalf, and they keep repeating the lie until people accept it and people say, well, this person has a biochemical imbalance in the brain, and you say, well, show me their laboratory test, and they can't because they don't have one.
Look,
so it's very important to note that there's no biochemical test for brain to see what a person's brain biochemistry is like. I mean, they can check them post-mortem, but if they do that, they don't know that death hasn't disturbed the brain biochemistry. Or if they actually force a probe into the brain, I mean, they're going to be inducing some kind of trauma, which you think would upset the biochemical imbalance. So we just can't test it. It's an untestable hypothesis. It's junk science to talk about biochemical imbalances in the brain.
Rochelle, your information you've given us so far is absolutely jaw-dropping, and I mean really, really, really important. I just want to take a short break.
Yep.
And I want to come back and just get into a bit of discussion about what you've already told us, because we need to understand the implications of this.
Yes.
Across, you know, this impacts our society, and a lot of people don't expect or don't understand that the connection between, you know, the power of psychiatry and other aspects of the loss of democracy that
yes.
we're seeing in our society. So we'll get back into that in a moment. So please just bear with us.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Okay, I'm here with Rochelle McCready, a lawyer with expertise in many issues around the problems with mental illness and involuntary detainment and incarceration. And we've been, you know, getting some really, really quality information from you there, Rochelle, which I hope that our listeners can make use of. And I hope they actually can get in touch with you and do so if they have issues or concerns of their own. I just wanted to point out a couple of things. You know, there's been examples. For example, in the Soviet Union, we know that political dissidents were treated with psychoactive, you know, neuroleptic drugs, as and they actually used the designation, you know, schizophrenia to define people who were political dissidents. We know that occurred.
Yes.
I know of at least one case that's come to me from New Zealand where a woman was locked up and was in a mental institution for several weeks because she said 9/11 was an inside job. I kid you not. And and she was eventually released, and they apologized for it. They had the decency to say it was a mistake. But she only got released because she actually had her father was actually a doctor and interceded on her behalf. But they were quite willing to lock her up as someone delusional because she said 9/11 was an inside job. Example, okay, at the moment, I'm not aware of psychiatry being used as a tool of political repression. But when you see the laws being ratcheted up, you see the potential for this to occur.
Yeah.
And even without that, it's bad enough as it is. And I'm not saying, you know, that that's the only thing we should be concerned about, but I do see a continuum there. And I was just reminded when you were talking before of a movie that was quite a popular movie about a year ago. It was a Clint Eastwood movie. It's called Changeling, and I recommend it because it's actually a true story. It was actually all based on facts, and it was about a woman whose child was abducted, and the police were very corrupt. It was in the 1930s, and the police were incredibly corrupt in Los Angeles, and they decided to make a big publicity stunt of returning her child to her. Only they didn't return her child; they returned another child that they just found off the street, and they forced her to acknowledge that it was her child, even when she knew it wasn't.
Yes.
And then when she started complaining that it was not her child, they sent psychiatrists around to her home and said, no, you better stop having these delusions or you're going to be taken to the hospital. And then, you know, she eventually took them to court, and then they arrested her under the Mental Health Act there, and she was detained. And it was a little bit over-dramatized for Hollywood, but it's a really interesting film. I don't know if you saw it.
No, I didn't, but I can tell you that a fairly similar sort of situation has occurred in the UK recently, where psychiatry has been used as a tool of repression to silence somebody. And this is with a mentally defective girl, Holly Greig. She has Down syndrome, and she was sexually abused by her father, who was the leader of a paedophile ring that involved several establishment figures in Scotland. And when her mother complained about it and they sought to have these people charged, a mental health crisis team turned up at the mother's door and carted her off. It's an absolute scandal. If people want to read about it, I suggest they visit UK Column and CP Exposed. It's written up a gentleman who is ex-Royal Navy. Brian Gerrish has been on the trail of this matter, and he does an enormous amount of good work exposing people and exposing how these sinister forces in society are using psychiatry and other methods to silence their opponents. I think the thing here, Harewood, is that psychiatry is a tool, a potential tool of repression, and that is why we have to be very careful about giving these people more power, because these changes are just the thin end of the wedge. I'm not suggesting that the present New South Wales government intend to use them to round up their opponents, but if a potential another government, a subsequent government somewhere down the track, wants to silence their opponents, then there's nothing to stop them under this legislation of rounding people up and declaring all political dissidents to be insane and forcing them to have psychiatric treatment. They could use the good old Russian condition, sluggish schizophrenia, and they could label just about anyone with that. You're spot on there. You're right on the money.
Extraordinary. Yeah, Josh, welcome back, Josh.
Yeah. It's quite interesting because, you know, we talk about this, you were saying earlier that the biochemical imbalances and no test for that, and oh, it's rubbish science, and it's so true. Yet, because they can sell pills for it, it's all fine. Now, when you have people coming out and saying, look, a really good diet of raw fruit, raw food and nutrition can actually cure cancer straight away. Rubbished, you know, straight away that sort of stuff is rubbished. And saying there's no tests for it, you can't do it, purely because there's no pill. It comes down to being, you know, it's quite cheap and you can basically eat really well. But there's no actual studies going into that stuff because there's no pills for it. Yet the massive pharmaceutical push behind the psychiatric world is so vast with riches that it's just bound to get corruption. And then when the government steps in there as well, people have to really open their eyes and be careful.
Yeah. I think, Josh, to some extent, it might sound a bit strange that I'm saying this, but I don't have a direct a quarrel with the pharmaceutical industries, because they're actually, psychiatrists are actually misusing their drugs. And this came out with Chelmsford. You know, it's psychiatric abuse that I think we need to target. I mean, the pharmaceutical industries are in there to sell drugs, but they're really not responsible for what these people are doing to people in psychiatric facilities. It's the psychiatrists who are engaging in psychiatric abuse who are doing these things. But I certainly do take your point about a good diet and proper medical treatment.
I guess I was just sort of trying to compare the notions that one thing, one thing's good for an industry where you don't need much proof, for anything. I mean, they can hardly even prove that ADD exists. When they say, what are the symptoms for ADD? And they're like, oh, well, don't know, really. They're all sorts.
Yeah, they drug people and they put them on drugs that cause brain damage. And in America, we've seen cases of where in some of the states, children have been removed from their parents. We saw one state where the parents were threatened and they said they would take the child away. In another instance that comes to mind, a school put massive pressure on the parents to drug their son, and the son ended up dying. Mm. He had a heart condition and the drugs killed him, and that was the coroner's finding. And the school said, you have to put him on these drugs to help him focus.
Yeah.
But they can't produce any evidence of biochemical imbalance or anything else. But, I mean, one thing can be shown is that people have developed brain damage post taking these drugs, and certainly the studies that have been run by psychiatrists claiming that ADHD and ADD brain abnormalities have very, very dodgy methodology, and that they haven't run controls, so they're pretty dubious sort of studies that push the drugging of people for this very vaguely defined condition.
I'd just like to point out that there's a well-known Australian psychiatrist by the name of Patrick McGorry, who's been advocating that people should be put on drugs before they've even been diagnosed as having a mental illness. Preventative treatment. Have you looked into that one at all, Rochelle?
Yes, I have. I've thrown my hands up in horror about this. I actually put some stuff on my blog about the early intervention program.
Yes.
It's an absolute scandal. I mean, this early intervention program was based on a single study in England in Buckinghamshire, and the results of this study have never been replicated anywhere else. But they proposed to treat people with psychiatric drugs. Now, the drugs that they've been giving people are actually capable of inducing the very condition that they are there to treat, which is psychosis. And that is in the drug company's own literature. And I can give people chapter and verse. I can actually refer them to that. And these drugs, despite this sort of repeated denial on the part of a lot of psychiatrists that atypical neuroleptics can cause the dreaded tardive dyskinesia. This is a condition where people develop involuntary movements, and it's the result of irreversible damage to the central nervous system. And they flatly deny that any modern drugs can cause this. But when you look at the drug company's own literature and the inserts that go in with some of these drugs, it's there, tardive dyskinesia. So these drugs are capable of causing tardive dyskinesia. But this early intervention program actually claimed that 51% of young people needed drugging.
Now, this is
just preposterous. When psychiatrists claim that at the most only 2-3% of the population are psychotic, and yet their nets, their catch-alls, have caught 51% of young people.
Oh yeah, but, I mean, you get also these strange things. I've heard somewhere where there's rewards of $500 to certain schools for every pupil they head towards they give towards promoting an ADD type medication.
Yes. And I've heard of this too.
What sort of rewards do they give? What was that, Josh? Are they
$500 per school, and every school needs more money. So
really?
All of a sudden you get this over-drugging and over Just, psychologists gone, psychiatrists.
Look, I've known quite a few people. I've had quite a few friends who've been on various psychiatric drugs. I've known quite a few people who've been on involuntary treatment programs. And what I know from all of them, including the ones that have just been on, prescribed antidepressants, is that these drugs have a massive effect on your physiology. So the idea of just giving them as a preventative in the way that you give someone vitamins is just so utterly ludicrous. I mean, these are highly psychoactive drugs.
You wouldn't
give someone any drug preventatively.
No.
And, because drugs always have risk associated with them. So that's why, for example, with chemotherapies for cancer, we know chemotherapies are actually quite dangerous. And, but they say, well, the cancer's going to kill you. So the chemotherapy will, if it doesn't kill the cancer first, you might die. So, you take the risk, right? Mm. It's a calculated risk. But you don't just go giving powerful psychiatric medications to someone who has not been diagnosed. But here's where it gets very fuzzy, because they talk about, in this article that I found on it, they were talking about, like, the teenager who sits in their room living in their own world and isn't very socially adapted. Well, is that a mental illness? Because, I mean, every teenager goes through a phase of being more social, less social. Some people are just more social and less social than others. Some of those less social people are incredibly creative. Some of them become geniuses. Some of them become musicians. Some of them do go insane. We know that. But the idea that you just take a behavioral...
Some of them do both.
Some of them do even... Yeah, great point, Josh. Yeah.
Yeah, well, see, this is the thing. I mean, no objective tests, and I think we're seeing shrinking social tolerance for any kind of non-conformity. There was the case of the late Ernie Ridding, the fridge man. You know, Ernie Ridding was a very public-spirited individual. He noticed that there are a lot of refrigerators dumped in council tips, and he also noticed that there are a lot of people in the community, pensioners and the unemployed, who needed working refrigerators but who couldn't afford to buy them. Mr. Ridding knew how to repair refrigerators, so he swapped around the parts and got working refrigerators together for them. He wouldn't take any money. He delivered these refrigerators to people who needed them.
Obviously crazy.
Well, a journalist, a man wrote a book about Ernest Ridding, and he described him as an eccentric. And when he was written about in the Sydney Morning Herald, he was described as an eccentric. Now, that is an appalling thing to say about someone.
Isn't it?
Couldn't they have said Mr. Ridding was a great philanthropist? He was a very public-spirited person. No, they said he's an eccentric. And I phoned up and I talked to one of the journalists about this, and I said, this man's been labelled an eccentric. Couldn't you think of anything positive to say about him? And she said, an eccentric isn't a bad word. And I said, look, have you looked up the dictionary and seen what eccentric means? And she had to admit that she hadn't. And I asked her if she consulted dictionaries to find the meanings of words. And she said no. And I said, well, you should, because I said dictionaries are the places where the meanings of words are found. And she said to me, that is only your opinion.
Oh, God.
I mean, talk about, postmodernism, but, I mean, eccentric means oddly unconventional. Fancy saying that somebody who fixed all these refrigerators and gave them to someone was oddly unconventional. But I had a clinical psychologist tell me that anybody who made a shopping list of things they needed and who kept that shopping list on their computer had a mental health problem and needed therapy.
Yeah. Oh, look, where does it stop? And that's the scary thing. Someone that might do something a little bit different, he wears two different color socks.
I've been accused of that in the past.
Lock him up.
Lock
her or him up. And honestly, folks, this is, we might be extrapolating to extremes, but this is the type of thing that happens when you take something into a logical progression to a step towards where something's heading.
Yeah.
And so one question I would like to ask you is, what does freedom mean to you in terms of individual liberty?
Oh, well, I mean, that means It means really no taxation without representation. It means that a person has a right to confront their accusers. And it means that a person can't lose their liberty without due cause and due process of law. And, I mean, these proposed changes to the Mental Health Act are just basically doing away with due process. You know, as I've said, psychiatric patients have fewer rights than criminals, and the few rights that they have are now being whittled away until we're heading towards the South Australian position where you're mad, we're going to lock you up, they've died. Oh, no, we want you to pay the bill for sort of keeping them locked up. That's it. You know, go to hell. We're not letting them out. They're mad. We keep them in. That's it. It's for their own good.
Yes, I had a friend. We were in high school, perfectly normal lad. And I know this is just a story, but it was very close to me. He went through, you know, he had problems at home. And he ended up taking acid or something like that. Had a bad trip. And ended up in a psychiatric hospital. Yeah. He's never left. He's in a government run home now, but he's on uppers and downers, pills to go to sleep, pills to wake up, experimental pills to change his mood, up, down, around, sideways, upwards, downwards, and he cannot function at all.
These drugs are addictive. These drugs are addictive, and that's one thing that particularly concerns me about this early intervention program, and that is that they have a withdrawal psychosis. You know, people take these drugs and they do seem to cause some kind of changes in the person's physiology, because when they discontinue them, even if they had no psychosis beforehand and the drugs are discontinued, they develop a rebound psychosis, which is of course interpreted by psychiatrists as a need for the medication in the first place. But you know, the psychosis is actually drug induced, and I think we've seen a number of alarming cases over the years where people have developed psychoses. They've had hydroponic marijuana, they've gone off their face, they've dropped acid or something like that. And instead of detoxing the people, which is should be done to them, I've had a number of responsible psychiatrists tell me this. They said these people should be detoxed and evaluated after they've been detoxified, but they don't. They just drug them straight away. And these drugs lock the condition in. They actually target the same part of the brain as the thing that sent them mad in the first place. So they're really throwing methylated spirits on fire.
Great. So, I mean, you know, the purpose of owning yourself, your own body, that concept goes all the way back to, you know, the Magna Carta. I mean, it really is something so intrinsic to freedom.
Yes.
And to have then another bunch of people just grab you off the streets, tell you you are something, force feed you drugs that you don't want and you can't do anything physically or legally against it, is such an abomination. And people must be wary, so wary of this. And I really applaud you for your work in standing up for the commoner on this most important topic.
Well, thanks. I want people to go to their local MPs now before anything is on the legislative drawing board and any sort of semi-permanent form. And I want them to say, these proposals have no place in a democracy. And I'm saying that people really do need to see their local members. Please don't think, well, I'll just bung them off an email or ring up the office and complain. Because these emails and telephone calls go to someone a long way down the food chain. You want to get the message to the person, to the MP. They're the ones who have their eye on the ballot box. You need to go and see them, even if you can't see them, if you see somebody in their office. I mean, you need to put your case politely but firmly, and you need to tell them, I am not happy with this. I don't want these changes. If you do this, and enough people do this, they won't be able to proceed with destroying our rights like this and making these dangerous changes, which are, you know, just another step along the way to undoing all the good the Slattery Royal Commission's recommendations did. And so what I'd just like to say to people is you can find to, this is a state matter, it's not a federal matter, so don't go and bother your federal MP, but they need to Google New South Wales Parliament and they can put in their postcode, they can find out who their MP is, they can find their contact details, and please do ask for an appointment to see the person and go along and just politely put your case to them and say, this is not acceptable to me. Because if enough people do it, we'll stop this.
Excellent. Yeah. Look, we're going to have to wind up shortly, Rochelle. So great that you came on today. Is there a website that you can recommend for Australians to get more information that you're connected with, or that just anything you could recommend?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Citizens Committee on Human Rights, with whom I'm allied, even though I'm not a Scientologist myself.
Yes, we should put the disclaimer on there because we know that that they are connected with Scientology. Just a disclaimer. I mean, we're certainly not Scientologists on this show, just in case you're wondering.
I'm not a Scientologist either, but I'd like to say that I think that the Scientologists are absolutely spot on in these things they've said about, mental health. But I think the CCHR websites, and I also have a blog, and I post information on the blog. I also put tweets on Twitter and stuff like this, referring people to the blog and various articles.
We'll put links to that on the show notes for sure. Yeah.
But one thing
Certainly.
We just have time for a
quote? I've got a couple more minutes. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Look, I'd like just like to quote the pastor Martin Niemöller, and I'm just saying that this is a good reason why people should go to their MPs and protest. He said, "When they came for the Jews, I was not a Jew, and so I did not protest. When they came for the trade unionists, I did not belong to a trade union. When they came for the Catholics, I was not a Catholic. When they came for me, there was no one left to protest." And I think that's what we need to look at.
It's a very important
quote. Because we shouldn't assess a system when it's operating at its best. We should assess a system when it's operating at its worst. And that's the scenario against which we must take precautions.
Yes, that quote often pops up in our discussions, and thank you very much for reminding us of that.
Thank you.
We have to be aware, and we try to cover on the show what's going on in society on a number of different areas. That's kind of what we do. We're making the connections, and we'll bring up this story again. We'll be following it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the program.
Absolutely. It's been a huge pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good night, Rochelle.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Rochelle McCready, a really excellent guest. And any information you need about her will be on our show notes.
Yeah, it's always good to see people that are active in their passion. And that's right. That's what we try to encourage here on the show, folks. If there's a subject you're passionate for, Get in there, get amongst it, really, rile up other people, start a blog, get out in the streets, start working in your profession and do something to help an issue that you're very passionate about.
I second that motion. And on that great grand note, we're going to say goodnight.
And remember to comment, folks. Come onto the show.
Yeah.
Truthnews.com.au and donate some words.
Comment, tweet, and get in it. Get amongst it.
Retweet us.
Good night from Truth News Australia.
Good night, folks.